HarperCollins presents These Infinite Threads by Tahereh Mafi, read by Kate Redding. Why did fate indulge the prince in luxury and ease, only to abandon him at the hands of his cruel slayers? The wise know there is no justice in this valley of tears. Abul Ghassem Ferdowsi, Shahnameh. Tell me about my end. When is it written for me to leave this world? Who will inherit my throne? Abul Ghassem Ferdowsi, Shahnameh. 1. Don't! Kamran shouted. The fire! The words died in his throat. He watched Aliza charge toward the thigh-high blaze with an astonishment so complete he sank to the ground, the cold of the stone floor seeping through the tattered silk of his trousers. Kamran had the benefit of heavy layers and jewel harnesses, at least. The fire had been unable to devour him with any speed. But Aliza wore little more than a whisper, so fine was the fabric of her gown. The fire will melt the flesh from her bones. He thought it even as she crossed the blaze without care, her gossamer dress inhaled in an instant by the fiery ring, an abomination magic to life by the young Tulanian king. Cyrus, the monarch in question, stood just opposite Kamran, sword still held aloft in anticipation of a fatal blow, his hand stayed only by the sight of Aliza, who headed toward him now. As if from outside himself, Kamran watched as she batted away flames from her dress with bare hands, snuffing the fire as one might a light. He stared down at the remains of his own disintegrated garments, then at the blood dripping between his knuckles. Slowly he looked back up at Aliza, possessing clarity of mind enough to register that she'd emerged from the inferno unscathed, even as her gown suffered. He blinked at the impossibility of it. He was either dreaming or deluded. He could not make sense of her. No, he could not make sense of anything. Aliza, who'd nearly tripped over the king's fallen crown in her haste, had sent the weighty heirloom spinning toward Kamran as she ran. He stared at that crown now, stared at it as a sudden tremor seized him, shock and cold combining, reminding him his grandfather was dead. King Zal was supine before the world, blood pooling beneath his lifeless body in the imperfect oval of an open-mouthed scream. His grandfather had bargained with the devil to extend his life, and in the end, death had devoured the king swiftly and without dignity, the sovereign and his sins withering in unison. The limp, corded muscle of twin white snakes, still soldered to the pale shoulders of a beloved king, painted a scene so grotesque it inspired in Kamran a sudden impulse to heave. He braced his unsteady hands on the icy floor and wondered, with increasing horror, how many street children had been sacrificed for his grandfather's serpents. It was an imagining too monstrous. Kamran was ill with disillusion, with denial. He willed himself to remain calm, to marshal his thoughts. But an unidentified agony clawed at his consciousness, the pain seeming to emanate from his left arm. He wished to be someone else. He wished to turn back time. Above all, he wished, without a mote of hyperbole, that Cyrus had been allowed to kill him. The whispers of their heretofore silent audience had been growing steadily in the interlude, and now built to an alarming crescendo, the din awaking in Kamran years of training and awareness. his mind sharpened against the gossip, duty piercing the fog of grief and replacing it with anger, focus. A sudden clatter. Kamran looked up in time to see Aliza toss Cyrus's sword to the floor, the young man flinching as glinting steel struck marble. The foreign king stared at Aliza with an astonishment to rival Kamran's, fear torpifying his features as she rounded on him. "How dare you," she said. "You horrible cretin! You useless monster! How could you? How did you?" Cyrus fumbled back an inch. "How did you walk through the fire like that? Why are you not burning?" "You despicable, wretched man," she cried. "You know who I am, but you don't know what I am." "No." Aliza struck Cyrus across the face with the force of a bludgeon, the impact so violent the young king staggered, audibly striking his head against a column. Kamran felt the shock of it in his bones. He knew he should rejoice in this moment, knew he should celebrate Aliza's actions against the depraved royal, but his mind would not submit to relief, for the scene unravelling before him did not align with reason. Cyrus appeared entirely too unnerved. The trepidation in his eyes, his astonishment at her approach, the blind steps he took backward as she advanced, it made no sense. Aliza had insisted to Kamran but moments ago that she did not know the Southern King, yet Cyrus, who'd more than proven his ruthlessness, displayed every sign of alarm in her presence. If they were truly strangers, why would he cower now at the unarmed advance of a girl he did not know? She'd tossed his sword to the floor, insulted him repeatedly, and slapped him in the face. And the young king who'd minutes ago buried a blade in Zal's heart hadn't so much as lifted a hand in his own defence. He'd only stood there and stared at her, and all but allowed her to strike him. Almost as if he feared her. Kamran dared not breathe, as a terrifying suspicion dawned in his mind, the thought provoking in him a spasm so acute he thought his chest might crater. From the first, Kamran had been mystified by Aliza's transformation at the ball. In a matter of hours, her injuries had miraculously healed. She'd discarded the iconic snudder of her servant's uniform, and her drab work dress had been replaced by an extravagant gown no maid could ever afford. And still he'd denied the truth, so desperate was he to absolve her of artifice. Finally, he understood. He had been deceived. His eyes flickered again to the fallen figure of his grandfather. King Zal had tried to warn him. He'd begged Kamran to see how Aliza was tethered to the prophecy, to the end of Zal's life. And only now that his grandfather was dead did Kamran understand the magnitude of his own folly. Every foolish word he'd spoken in her defence, every stupid childish action he'd taken to protect her. Without warning, Cyrus laughed. Kamran looked up. The Southern King appeared pale and disordered. From where he knelt, Kamran could not see Aliza's face. He saw only the horror in Cyrus's eyes as he looked her over. The young man had killed his own father for the throne of Tulan. He'd newly murdered King Zal, the ruler of the greatest empire on earth. He would have killed Kamran too, had he been granted but a moment more to accomplish the task. Now the copper-headed tyrant steadied himself slowly, blood seeping from his lips, smeared across his chin. Of all the adversaries they might have encountered, it seemed they'd both been cowed by the poor gentle servant of Bar's house. "Damn the devil to hell," the Tulanian king said quietly. "He didn't tell me you were a djinn. Who? Aliza demanded. Our mutual friend. Hazan? Kamran recoiled. He'd not been prepared for the blow of yet another betrayal, and the impact of that single word lanced through his body with a ruthlessness against which he had no defense. That she was somehow allied with Cyrus was torture enough, but that she'd gone behind his back with Hazan? This was more than he could bear. She'd play-acted at fear and innocence, had outmaneuvered him at every turn, and worst of all, he had fallen madly for her manipulations. In all the time he'd known her, Aliza had clung to her snodder, fighting to hide her identity, even in the midst of a rainstorm. Now she stood unmasked before a sea of nobles, glowering at the formidable sovereign of a neighbouring nation, declaring herself to the world. All this time, Aliza had been making plans. Already Kamran had been attacked by grief and anger. He struggled even then to digest the magnitude of the last moments, could hardly piece together his discordant thoughts about his grandfather. But now he was expected to make sense of this? He, who prided himself on the strength of his instincts, he, who believed himself to be a capable, intuitive soldier. Hazan? Cyrus laughed again, his hand trembling almost imperceptibly as he wiped blood from his mouth. Hazan? Of course not, Hazan. Cyrus locked eyes with Kamran and said, Pay attention, King, for it seems even your friends have betrayed you. Aliza turned suddenly to face him, eyes wide with panic, and her obvious flush of guilt was all the evidence Kamran required. Just hours ago, he would have sworn an oath that her desire for him was as palpable as the press of satin against his skin. He'd tasted the salt of her, had felt the exquisite shape of her body under his hands. Now he knew it had all been a lie. Hell. This was hell. But to say that this revelation had broken his heart would be to misrepresent the truth. Kamran was not heartbroken, then. No, he was incandescent with rage. He would kill her. Any naive, lingering softness in Kamran's heart evaporated. He'd been seduced by a siren while being deceived by his own friend, and had all but spat in the face of the only person who truly cared for his well-being. King Zal had sold himself to evil in the pursuit of Kamran's happiness, and the man was repaid with only disloyalty and treason. This dark night had been wrought by Kamran's actions alone. He understood that now. The entire Ardunian Empire had been left vulnerable because he'd been frail of mind and body. Never again. Never again would he allow a woman to own his emotions. Never again would he be made weak by such base temptations. He swore it then. This monster from the prophecy would die by his hand. He would drive a blade through her heart or die trying. But first, Hazan. Kamran caught the eye of a guard hovering, awaiting orders, and with a single glance, he issued his first decree as King of Ardunia. Hazan would hang. Kamran experienced no victory as he watched his former minister seized, then dragged away. He felt no triumph at the sound of Hazan's feeble protests, ringing out through the astonished silence of the room. No, Kamran suffered only the ascent of a terrifying madness as he forced himself upright, daring to bear weight on his injured arm in the process, and realizing only in the excruciating effort that his legs too had been badly burned. His skin and clothes were sticky with blood. His head felt leaden. It was a truth he was loath to admit, that he did not know how much longer he could stand here without the aid of a surgeon or a diviner. No! The royal diviners were dead, slaughtered by Cyrus. Kamran's eyes squeezed shut at the reminder. Iblis. His eyes flew open at the sound of her soft, traitorous voice. Kamran's heart began pounding anew, startling him with its intensity. He couldn't decide then what disturbed him more, to realize that she and Cyrus shared a mutual friend in the devil, or to discover that his body still wanted her, still heated at the mere sound of her voice. She had disappeared. Panicked, Kamran searched for her and was unsuccessful. Instead, he saw Cyrus, still staring intently at what could only be Aliza, who'd a moment ago been speaking. Without warning, she materialized. Aliza stood in precisely the same spot, except now she appeared hazy, oscillating in and out of focus with a dizzying consistency. Was she doing this to him? Had she access to dark magic? Where once was Aliza stood now a milky blur of movement, her voice warped and waterlogged, reverberating as if she were speaking from inside a glass jar. Kamran dragged bloody hands down his face. As if each revelation weren't already more annihilating than the last, he was now blind and deaf too?
Send you interest he, my life.
His injured legs failed as his mind fractured. He trembled, hands grasping at air as he sought purchase, and fell hard onto one badly burned leg. He nearly cried out in agony, but then, a mercy. The Tulanian king spoke, his words lucid. Is it not obvious? He wants you to rule. A terrible thunder filled Kamran's head. There was no time to rejoice in the restoration of his hearing. The demon-like monster with ice in its veins had been foretold to have formidable allies, and here was further evidence of the diviner's wisdom, of his grandfather's warnings. The devil himself was assisting her. The crowd was growing louder now, and he could hear them too, whispers having evolved into shouts and hysterics. Kamran was reminded once more that all the nobles of Ardunia were collected in this room. The highest-ranking officials from across the empire had been brought together for an evening of decadence and celebration. Instead, they would bear witness to the fall of the greatest empire in the world. Kamran did not know how he would survive it. He heard Cyrus laugh again, heard him say clearly, "A djinn queen to rule the world. Oh, it's so horribly seditious. The perfect revenge." Again, Kamran attempted to draw himself up. His head pounded with a vengeance, his eyesight still an uncertain thing. The room, the floor, Cyrus himself, were all perfectly clear. But Aliza remained more nimbus than person, a series of halos, stacked in the general shape of a body. Then again, just knowing where to aim might be enough. This evening's admissions had more than proven his grandfather's every warning about the girl, and Kamran would die before he failed the man twice. His sword lay a few feet away, and though the distance seemed insurmountable, Kamran would force himself to clear it. He might be able to bury the blade in her heart now, kill her now, end this tragedy tonight. He just managed to take an agonizing step toward his sword when the haze of her shifted away from Cyrus. Then, in a flash of kismet, Kamran could see Aliza's face. She looked terrified. The sight speared him through the chest at the precise moment the cataracts in his eyes seemed to clear. Her figure came suddenly into sharp focus, and oh, this was a cruel fate, indeed. Aliza was an enemy, possessed of a power he never could have imagined. Even now, her shining eyes glittered with an emotion that destroyed him.
Her guile was so graceful, so natural. She searched the room as if she were truly frantic. Kamran cursed the wretched organ in his chest, then pounded a clenched fist against his sternum as if to kill it. In response, a terrible anguish ripped through his body. So brutal the sensation, it took his breath away. It was as if a tree had planted in a single shot at his feet, the trunk suturing to his spine, tremendous branches pushing violently through his veins. He doubled over, gasping, almost missing the moment when Aliza glanced up in his direction, and then bolted without warning, exiting the inferno once again unscathed. Had she seen him reaching for his sword? Had she gleaned his intentions? Aliza was a maddening sight, even as she fled, the gauzy layers of her gown having now been incinerated twice. She flew past in little more than scraps of transparent silk. He could see every lush curve of her body, the lithe shape of her legs, the swell of her breasts, and he hated himself for wanting her, even now. Hated himself for the hunger he felt as he watched her go. Hated the instincts that screamed at him, despite all logical evidence to the contrary, that she was in danger, that he should go to her, protect her. "Wait! Where are you going?" Cyrus shouted. "We had a deal. Under no circumstances were you allowed to run away." "We had a deal." The words rang in his head. Over and over, each syllable striking his mind like a scythe, drawing blood. By the angels, how many more blows need his body survive tonight? "I must," she cried, the agitated crowd leaping apart to let her pass. I'm sorry, but I have to leave. I need to find somewhere to hide, somewhere he won't. At once, Aliza doubled over, as if struck by an invisible force, and was promptly jerked upward, into the air. She screamed. Kamran reacted without thinking, a rush of adrenaline propelling him upright, dregs of stupidity compelling him to cry out her name. He pushed as close to the edge of the flaming Bastille as he dared, the anguish in his voice no doubt betraying him to the world, if not to himself. But he could not think on it then. Aliza was being launched higher and higher in the air, twisting and screaming, and Kamran condemned himself for his tortured response to her suffering. Even then, he couldn't fathom the battle being waged inside his body. "Make it stop," she screamed. "Put me down." Sudden understanding forced Kamran to look Cyrus in the eye.
"You,"
he said, hardly recognizing the rasp of his own voice.
"You're doing this to her."
Cyrus's expression darkened. "She's done it to herself." Kamran was prevented from responding by the sound of yet another tortured cry. He spun around in time to see Aliza spiraling toward the rafters. She was, without a doubt, in the grip of a very dark magic, and promptly lost his battle with sense. He could not fathom this chaos into order, could not answer the multitude of questions that hounded him. Kamran felt unmoored as he watched her. Aliza was a force so powerful, she claimed the devil as a friend, knew the sovereign of an enemy nation as an ally. She'd used dark magic to create illusions so compelling he'd truly believed she'd suffered physical blows to her hands, her throat, her face. She'd tricked even King Zal into believing she was a helpless, ignorant servant girl. And yet, she sobbed then with a hysteria so believable that even he... "You can see her." The statement startled him. Kamran turned back to Cyrus, assessing in an instant his enemy's copper hair, his cold blue eyes. Of all the things Cyrus might have said, this was particularly strange, and Kamran was too discerning to dismiss it as meaningless. That Cyrus appeared surprised Kamran could see her seemed to point to a simple inverse. Perhaps others could not. It was a theory that explained nothing, yet seemed somehow vitally important. Kamran wondered then about the source of his temporary blindness, and renewed fear branched up his back.
"What?" Kamran said carefully. "Did you do to her?"
Cyrus did not answer. Lazily, the southern king pushed himself off the column before bending to pick up his sword. He walked toward Kamran with affected unconcern, dragging the blade behind him like a dog on a leash. The eerie exhalation of steel against stone briefly overpowering the sounds of Aliza's screams. "I thought she broke through the fire to punish me," Cyrus was saying. "I see only now that she did so to protect you." There was a flicker in those blue irises, and for a second, Cyrus betrayed himself. Beneath his placid surface was something desperate and unrestrained, if not broken. Kamran catalogued the moment as a kind of mercy, for he realised then that the young man was a king weaker than he appeared. "You know her name," Cyrus said softly. Kamran felt a pulse of trepidation, but said nothing. "How?" Cyrus demanded. "Did you come to know her name?" When Kamran finally spoke, his voice was heavy, cold.
"I might ask you the same question."
"Indeed you might," said Cyrus, who was lifting his sword by inches. "But then it's my prerogative to know the name of my bride." A sharp pain exploded in Kamran's chest, just as an ear-splitting crash broke open the room. He fought back a cry, clasping his ribs as he fell once more to his knees, heaving through the brutality of the blow. Kamran had no idea what was happening to him, and there was no time to hazard a guess. He could only force his eyelids open in time to witness not merely the destruction of his home, but the arrival of an enormous iridescent dragon, the sight of which seemed to drain the blood from his body. The diviners would never have allowed a foreign beast to enter Ardunian skies, but the diviners were dead. Kamran watched the dragon catch Aliza just as she began a sudden dizzying descent, the monstrous creature seating the young woman firmly on its back before launching upward once more. The animal gave a stalwart roar, flapped its leathery wings, and, in a blink, both beast and rider were gone, vanishing into the night through the cavernous hole newly blown through the palace wall. In the preceding chaos, Kamran could no longer deny the devastation of his mind. The grief of losing his grandfather had only just begun to penetrate, and each subsequent betrayal had broken him not unlike a series of other small deaths, each one a violent injustice, each one demanding a period of mourning. Zal had been false. Hazan had been false. Aliza had ruined him. Somehow he still heard the uproar of the crowd, felt the oppressive heat of his cage, the insistent cold of the marble floor under his knees. He lacked the strength to stand. Pain was streaking relentlessly across his body in a steady rhythm that showed no signs of abating. Slowly, Kamran lifted his head, looked Cyrus in the eye. He felt so raw, his throat seemed to bleed as he spoke.
"Is it true?" he asked. "She's really going to marry you?"
Cyrus stepped forward, his sword at the ready. "Yes." Kamran would not recover. He grimaced as fresh pain exploded up his neck, across his shoulders. The action was so unrehearsed, even Cyrus frowned. "Fascinating," said the Tulanian king, who then lifted Kamran's chin with the tip of his sword. Kamran, who could hardly breathe through the torment, still managed to jerk backward, the movement provoking a fresh deluge of suffering. "You appear to be dying."
"No,"
Kamran gasped, bracing his hands against the stone floor. Cyrus almost laughed. "Unless you intend to follow in your grandfather's footsteps, I don't believe you have a choice in the matter." From where he drew the strength, Kamran did not know, but he heaved himself up off the floor with the kind of fortitude born only of a broken man, a reckless one. Kamran had been hollowed out. In the space of an hour, the threads of his entire life had come apart. He felt mad and feverish in the aftermath, a bit like he was moving through a nightmare. Somehow, the horrors had fortified him. He felt he had nothing left, nothing to lose. He reached for his sword, as if his arm wasn't still bleeding out, as if the flesh of his legs had not been recently charred. It seemed a miracle at all that he managed to lift the blade, face his opponent. He heard a storm of footfalls then, a chorus of concerned voices, as a brigade of guards surged closer to the fiery ring, but Kamran stayed them with a single hand. This was his fight to finish. Cyrus glanced at these armed onlookers, then considered the prince for what felt like a long time. "Very well," the southern king said finally. "Never say I'm not merciful. I'll make this quick. You will not suffer."
"And I,"
Kamran said, the rasp of his voice like gravel,
"will make certain that your torment is never-ending."
A flash of anger, and Cyrus's sword cut through the air in a single blinding strike, which Kamran met with surprising force, even as his broken body shook in the effort. His legs trembled, his arms screamed in anguish, but Kamran would not capitulate. He'd rather die fighting than surrender. And it was this thought that heated his chest, that generated within him a second life, a terrifying adrenaline. Happily, he would perish in the effort. With a guttural cry, he managed to push against his opponent, launching Cyrus backward, freeing his sword. Kamran advanced without delay, moving now with shocking swiftness as he lunged, as Cyrus parried. For a time, all Kamran heard was steel. He saw nothing but the sheen of metal, waves of blades crashing, escaping. Cyrus fainted, then sprang forward with surprising alacrity, and, too late, Kamran felt the burn of his injury. He heard the panicked shrieks of the crowd, but he couldn't see the laceration. In fact, he was hardly able to identify which aspect of his body had been injured. There was no time. Kamran moved to stave off a second attack, experiencing a brief moment of triumph when Cyrus fell back with a muttered oath. The southern king rallied without delay, meeting Kamran blow for blow in a series of strikes so precisely choreographed, even Kamran was not immune to the beauty of it. There was a rare pleasure in fighting a worthy adversary, in testing without restraint the potential of one's power. But this evidence of Cyrus's prowess and lightning-fast reflexes only cemented Kamran's certainty that the southern king had earlier allowed Aliza to overpower him. To the prince, this behaviour pointed to one of only two explanations. Either she was his superior in their arrangement, or he hadn't wanted to hurt her. Perhaps both. Maybe they really were betrothed. This shattering thought brought him alive with an alarming strength, the breadth of which remained unfamiliar to him. He knew only that his instincts were sharper than he'd ever felt them, and he soon saw a faint strain in Cyrus's face, the sheen of sweat at his brow, no doubt mirrored upon his own features. Both were breathing hard, but even as blood dripped down Kamran's hands, his every motion staining the marble underfoot, he did not tire. Again, he advanced. The young men crossed swords in a movement so violent Kamran felt the tremor move through his entire body. They were trapped in a Herculean standstill. Adversaries locking eyes through the glimmer of their blades. Then, for no fathomable reason, Cyrus faltered. It was only a fraction of a second that the Tulanian king frowned, that his focus was distracted, but Kamran did not misuse the opportunity. With brute force, he bore down, compelling Cyrus to fall back into a crouch. Kamran had the advantage now. All he had to do was break his opponent. There would be great satisfaction in spearing Cyrus through the heart. Kamran already knew he would have him disemboweled. He would display the bloody organs under a glass cloche in the town square, let the maggots find them and feast freely. "I feel you should know," Cyrus said heavily, the fatigue of exertion apparent on his face, "that something is happening to you, to your skin." This Kamran ignored. Cyrus was trying to unsettle him, and he would not allow it, not when he was this close to victory. With a sudden cry, Kamran propelled his opponent back a final time, and Cyrus fell to the floor with a harsh exhale, his sword clattering as it struck marble. Kamran wasted no time, approaching his fallen rival with a ferocious determination. One final time he raised his sword and froze. A breathtaking paralysis took hold of his body where he stood. So severe the sensation that Kamran could hardly breathe. He watched, as if pressed between panes of glass, as Cyrus clambered to his feet, sheathed his sword, retrieved his staff, and searched for his hat. Once the strange article was settled firmly on the tyrant's head, he walked up to Kamran's statue and smiled. "There is very little honour left in me, melancholy king. Certainly not enough to die when I deserve it." In the distance, someone screamed. Kamran thrashed against the prison of his own body, but he felt his lungs weakening by the second, his organs being compressed from the outside in. Cyrus's smile did not waver. "Unfortunate as it is," he went on, "a flicker of humanity persists in animating my flesh. So I will leave you tonight with a beating heart. Anyway, it's better if you live, isn't it? Better for you to suffer consciously, to grieve your vile grandfather, to live every day with the knowledge that you've been betrayed not only by those you loathe, but by those you love, and to fail tremendously while trying to lead a pathetic empire." Kamran felt his heart seizing in his chest, his eyes burning with the threat of emotion. "No," he wanted to cry. "No, no." "I look forward to fighting you again," said Cyrus softly, tipping his hat. "But first, you'll have to find me." Then he vanished. 2. For a long time, Aliza did not move. She felt paralyzed by fear and disbelief, her mind assaulted by a tumult of uncertainty. Slowly, sensation returned to her limbs, to the tips of her fingers. She soon felt the wind against her face, saw the night sky drape itself around her, a midnight sheet studded with stars. By degrees, she began to relax. The beast was heavy and solid, and seemed to know where it was going. She took deep lungfuls of air, trying to clear the dregs of her panic, to convince herself that she would be safe, for at least as long as she clung to this wild creature. She shifted suddenly, at the feel of soft fibres grazing her skin through what was left of her thin gown, and looked down to examine it. She hadn't realised she was in fact sitting on a small carpet, which Aliza nearly screamed again. The dragon had disappeared. It was still here. She felt the beast beneath her, could still feel the leathery texture of its skin, but the creature had gone invisible in the sky, leaving her floating on a patterned rug. It was deeply disorienting. Still, she understood then why the creature had disappeared. Without its bulk to blind her, she could see the world below, could see the world beyond. Aliza didn't know where she was going, but for the moment, she forced herself not to panic. There was, after all, a strange peace in this, in the quiet that surrounded her. As her nerves relaxed, her mind sharpened. Quickly she yanked off her boots and chucked them into the night. It gave her great satisfaction to watch them disappear into the dark. Relief! A sudden thud shifted the weight of the rug, startling her upright. Aliza spun around, her heart racing once again in her chest, and when she saw the face of her unwelcome companion, she thought she might fling herself into the sky with the boots. "No," she whispered. "This is my dragon," said the Tulanian king. "You are not allowed to steal my dragon."
"I didn't steal it. The creature took... Wait, how did you get here? Can you fly?"
He laughed at that. "Is the mighty empire of Ardunia really so poor in magic that these small tricks impress you?"
"Yes," she said, blinking. Then, "What is your name?"
"Of all the non-sequiturs, why do you need to know my name?"
"So that I may hate you more informally."
"Ah, well, in that case, you may call me Cyrus."
"Cyrus," she said. "You insufferable monster. Where on earth are we going?"
Her insults seemed to have no effect on him, for he was still smiling when he said, "Have you really not figured it out?"
"I'm entirely too agitated for these games. Please just tell me what horrible fate awaits me now."
"Oh, the very worst of fates, I'm sorry to say. We are currently en route to Toulon."
The Noster burned hot against her skin, and Aliza felt herself go rigid with fear.
She was stunned, yes, and horrified too, but to hear the king of an empire denigrate his own land thus.
"Is Toulon really so terrible a place?"
"Toulon?" His eyes widened with surprise. "Not at all. A single square inch of Toulon is more breathtaking than all of Ardunia. And I say that as a discernible fact, not as a subjective opinion."
"But then," she frowned, "why did you say that it would be the very worst of fates?"
"Ah, that." Cyrus looked away, searched the night sky. "Well, you remember how I said I owed our mutual friend a very large debt?"
"Yes."
"And that helping you was the only repayment he would accept?" She swallowed.
"Yes."
"And do you remember how I told you that he wanted you to rule? To be a djinn queen?"
Aliza nodded.
"Well, you have no kingdom," he said. "No land to lord over. No empire to lead."
"No," she said softly. "I don't."
"Well then, you are coming to Toulon," Cyrus said, taking a quick breath. "To marry me."
Aliza gave a sharp cry and fell off the dragon.
She heard Cyrus unleash a torrent of foul language as she fell, the wind rushing up against her feet, and found, to her surprise, that though she actively pitched toward what could only be certain death, she could not summon the appropriate response. Aliza did not scream, neither did she experience fear. This unusual reaction to a sudden plummet from the heavens was in part precipitated by an ambivalence toward the direction her life had recently taken, for Aliza had thought, in absconding with the dragon, that she would at the very least be running away from the machinations of Iblis. She'd not realized that her actions, inadvertent or otherwise, had in fact delivered her directly into his diabolical plans. Aliza did not think of herself as a particularly maudlin person, but just then she couldn't bring herself to care whether she survived. Then again, her uncommon calm was perhaps a result of a far simpler reasoning. Aliza knew she would be saved. She'd hardly generated the thought when she heard the diminished roar of an inconvenienced dragon, the flap of its heavy wings funneling fierce gusts in her direction. This was twice in the same hour that Aliza had fallen from a great height, and as the frigid wind tore at her body, chapping her skin, she realized with a detached sort of amusement that her yards of black curls had come loose of their pins entirely. The midnight locks lapped at the air around her like strange tongues, several restless tendrils curling around her eyes, her mouth, her throat, her shoulders. Aliza was blinded by her own body, thoroughly windswept, downhearted, and quite possibly frozen solid. True, Aliza was always cold. The ice that marked her as heir to an ancient kingdom ensured that she rarely, if ever, enjoyed a bout of warmth. Couple this with the brutality of the winter night, the unrelenting winds that walloped her now, and the fact that she wore mere scraps in place of a gown. It was a surprise to Aliza that she was not yet a corpse. Still, she made no response at all when the dragon came up underneath her, registering only a muted shout before Cyrus's warm hands circled her waist, plucking her from the air as if she were an itinerant flower. He drew her firmly onto the carpet beside him, where she landed with a teeth-chattering thud, and after which he drew away from her with unflattering haste. She took note of it all as if watching through fog, for Aliza seemed suddenly incapable of emotion. She felt not unlike a rag doll, unable to animate. All seemed irretrievably lost. Hazan would hang. King Zal was dead. Kamran was in danger. Ardunia's royal diviners had been murdered. The palace had been attacked. Kamran had been injured when she left. How would he receive swift treatment without the diviners? How long would he be left vulnerable before they were able to gather a new quorum of priests and priestesses? Even Aliza, who'd witnessed the devastation of her own life in the last hours, could see clearly that Kamran had suffered a series of similar travesties. As if the death and disgrace of his grandfather had not been enough to endure, Aliza could still picture the look on Kamran's face when he realized Hazan had betrayed him, when he seemed to think that she too had been disloyal. No! No, she could not bear it. Every hope she had recently privately clasped to her chest, every effort she had made these last several years to build herself a quiet, protected life, every back-breaking labour to which she had submitted herself in hopes of securing a quiet future, she shuttered her mind against the thoughts. There was an unconscious part of Aliza that seemed to understand that if she unlocked the pain in her chest, she might not survive it. Much better, she thought, to keep it leashed. In any case, it was the devil who'd done this to her, who'd designed grand plans of torture for her. And here was proof. His disciple sat beside her.
"Will you not say something?" said Cyrus, his voice uncharacteristically subdued.
Aliza felt as if her lips were numb.
"I will not."
"You will not speak?"
"I will not marry you," Cyrus sighed.
The two sat in a terrible silence, darkness inhaling them both. The magnificent skies were her only consolation then, for even as she clenched her teeth ever more desperately against the glacial atmosphere, Aliza refused to be immune to the midnight sea upon which they appeared to sail, nor to the resilience of stars burning holes in the heavens. This was a habit Aliza had mastered long ago. Cataloguing moments of grace, even in the midst of disaster, often helped steady her mind. Indeed, there had been days in her life so bleak that Aliza had resorted to counting her teeth, if only to prove she still owned something of value. Just then, she forced herself to listen to the susurrations of the wind, to appreciate that she'd never seen the moon so close in all its unobstructed glory. She drew in a deep breath at the thought, tasting pure cold on her tongue, and lifted a searching hand to the night. The skies passed under her fingertips, much like a cat, demanding to be pet. "Abandon the idea," Cyrus said sharply, wrenching open the silence. "Your efforts will be futile." Aliza did not look up.
"I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about."
"Fling yourself into the sky as many times as you like. There will be no escape. I will not allow you to die."
"Do you speak to all young women with such ardent affection?" Aliza asked steadily, even as her bones shook with cold. "If I swoon and fall off the dragon again, you will have only yourself to blame."
Cyrus made a sound, something that was almost a laugh, and which quickly evaporated.
"Your first attempt has already cost us precious minutes. Should you insist upon throwing yourself over and over, you will only put us behind schedule and irritate my dragon, which she doesn't deserve. It's well past her bedtime. You need not torture her."
"Careful now," Aliza said to him. "You're in grave danger of suggesting you might care about this dragon."
Cyrus sighed, looked away.
"And you appear to be in grave danger of freezing to death."
"I am not," she lied.
Without a word, he removed his heavy, unadorned black coat. But as he leaned forward to drape it over her shoulders, Aliza stayed the gesture with a single hand.
"If you think," she said carefully, "that I will ever accept an article of clothing from you again, then you, sir, are deluded."
She saw the uncertain movement in his chest, the sudden tension in his jaw.
"There is no danger to be derived from this garment. It was only the gesture of a gentleman."
She felt a spark of heat near her sternum, just as surprise widened her eyes.
"A gentleman? Do you often confuse yourself for such a man?"
"With what ease you insult me," he said, his eyes mocking. "Were you anyone else, I'd have you executed."
"Goodness, more poetry. Are these tender declarations meant to endear you to me?"
He fought a smile at that, running a hand through his hair as he looked up at the stars.
"Tell me, is it too much to hope for our future that you will not make it a habit of slapping me in the face?"
"Yes."
"I see. Then married life will be exactly as I imagined."
"Let me be plain. I detest you. I would sooner ingest poison than marry you. And I am astonished to discover that you think I'd even consider submitting to such a horror, when it is clear your every action is predicated upon the demands of the devil himself. You are an incorrigible reprobate. How you could ever hope to be a gentleman, I will never understand."
Cyrus was quiet for a beat too long. He did not meet her eyes when he spoke, not even when he forced a smile.
"Do let us cast aside decorum, then. I promise to never again endeavour to be a gentleman in your presence."
"Is there any point, sir, in setting a goal for an accomplishment already achieved?"
Cyrus tensed, before turning suddenly to face her, his eyes glinting in the moonlight with something like fury. He said nothing as he allowed his gaze to travel, too slowly, from her eyes to her lips, down the column of her neck, the curve of her breasts, the narrowing line of her barely there bodice, then lower.
"You really are a terrible scoundrel," she whispered,
hating the way she flushed under his attentions. For all the darkness that enveloped them, there was a great deal of illumination too. She could see Cyrus quite plainly in the glaze of starlight, the lustre of the moon. It could not be denied. His was an objectively striking face, so much so that Eliza could not decide whether it was the wicked copper of his hair or the piercing blue of his eyes that proved his greatest asset. Then again, she did not care to decide, for not only was she unmoved by his beauty, she nursed a private hope that, given the right opportunity, she might be able to kill him.
"That dress was meant to protect you," Cyrus said bitterly. "I wasn't expecting you to set it on fire. Twice."
The noster warmed against her skin, and Eliza drew a sharp breath. She'd never been more grateful for the noster, the marble-sized magical orb that sorted truths from lies. She'd tucked it deep into her corset before Cyrus's abrupt arrival in Miss Hooder's bedroom, but after her most recent spiral from the heavens, she'd nearly forgotten its existence. Remembering it was with her did a great deal to fortify her heart, for she'd now acquired enough key information to know, unequivocally, that Hazan and Cyrus had not worked in tandem to assist her, which meant that Cyrus need never know that she possessed the powerful object. No matter the horrors ahead, at least she would always know whether he lied. Eliza experienced a pang of heartache at that realization, for it was Hazan who'd gifted her the Noster, and it seemed a categorical fact that she would never see him again. He would no doubt hang at dawn. It was Hazan who'd brought hope back into her life, whose existence inspired her to imagine an end to the wretchedness of her days. Hazan was proof that there remained any djinn who still searched for her, believed in her. Eliza had not known his true identity, that he was in fact a minister to the crown, that he worked alongside the prince every day. He'd risked his life in the attempt to transport Eliza to safety, and he would pay the price for it now. It was a sacrifice she would never forget.
"Had I known you'd incinerate the gown, I might not have wasted so much magic in its making," Cyrus was saying, shaking his head. "Much good it did you in the end. That dress was meant to hide you from any who wished you harm. Instead, you destroyed it, exposing in the process both your identity and your undergarments to all of Ardunian royalty. You must be well pleased with yourself."
"I beg your pardon?"
Eliza looked up at him in horror.
"My undergarments?"
"Surely you possess a pair of eyes," he said, staring intently at her face. "You are practically naked."
"How dare you?"
In a fluid motion, Cyrus draped his coat over her shoulders, surprising her so completely she'd no chance to protest before she was rendered powerless by relief. The lingering warmth of the wool garment was crossed with the heady masculine scent of its owner, but Eliza could ignore this. The heavy coat enveloped every inch of her folded, huddled body, its silk lining caressing, then soothing her wind-chapped skin. Eliza tried to resist this luxury, but no matter her silent castigations toward herself, she could not animate her arms enough to shrug off the article. The satisfaction was in fact so painful that treacherous tears sprang to her eyes, and she had to bite her lip to keep from making a sound of pleasure. When she finally looked up, she found Cyrus watching her, bewildered.
"You've been truly suffering," he said. "Why did you say nothing?"
She was unable to meet his eyes when she confessed quietly,
"I am always suffering. The frost lives with me much like an unwanted limb. It does not diminish. I seldom dwell on it."
"Then the frost is a real lived experience?"
Cyrus seemed to frown as he spoke.
I've heard mention of it, of course, but I'd assumed it was meant to be a poetic turn of phrase.
She'd forgotten. Cyrus had known only a little of her heritage. Aliza squeezed her eyes shut and exhaled, grateful her body seemed to be losing the worst of its tremors. The ice marks me as heir to the lost Jin Empire. The brutal cold is meant to prove my mettle, she explained. Those who cannot survive the ravages of the frost in the body are not expected to survive the ravages of the throne.
Softly, Cyrus said, You really do exist, then. You're not merely a fairy tale.
Aliza's eyes flew open.
What do you mean?
I'm not ignorant of Jin folklore, he said, turning away. This world has many failed royals. I assumed you'd be some coddled, uncrowned queen from a collapsed empire too small to be remembered. But you're the one they've been waiting for, aren't you? The one it seems even the devil has been waiting for. It would patch the holes in the many riddles he's fed me, and it would explain why he covets you so desperately.
Yes,
Aliza whispered, feeling more like a fraud in every moment.
She was meant to be the savior of her people? She, who'd spent the last few years of her life scrubbing floors and toilets?
I suppose I am.
In response, Cyrus only sighed. When Aliza finally dared to look at him, she found him staring into his black hat, his fingers tracing the brim. The sight of it made her wonder.
Earlier tonight, you used magic to transport us to the ball, she said. Why not do the same to deliver us to Tulan? The dragon seems a bit much.
Cyrus's hands stilled. He looked up slowly, his eyes glittering in the radiance of the firmament. There was no censure, only surprise, when he said,
You really know nothing about magic, do you?
She shook her head.
Very little.
And yet, he frowned, I have been informed that you require it, that in fact you possess inside yourself its most essential elements, somehow. Are you truly ignorant of your fate?
Aliza felt a bolt of fear at that, a familiar thrum as her heart began to race in her chest. It was only now occurring to Aliza just how much the devil might have divulged about her life to this veritable stranger. It put her at a terrible disadvantage.
What else has he told you about me? She asked.
Who? Iblis?
Aliza's breaths were coming faster now, dread mounting. His was an inane question, one she would not answer, and Cyrus, who was not stupid, soon sighed.
As I said, he intimated only that you were a queen from another empire, one who'd lost her throne and sought a kingdom elsewhere. He did not tell me you were a djinn.
A beat, and then...
Or if he did, it was not clear.
The Noster sparked warm.
His asinine riddles make it damn near impossible to understand him sometimes, Cyrus muttered, his expression souring. Then again it all seems to work out to his advantage. Such convoluted communications appear to be quite effective at fleecing susceptible humans.
Yes, Aliza said,
surprised to experience an alignment of sympathies with the Southern King.
I know the feeling well. He's been haunting me since I was born.
Cyrus met her eyes, studying her with something like caution.
I cannot magic myself. Or others, across great distances. The half-life of the mineral is too short.
Aliza did not understand this explanation, but just as she was deciding whether to expose her ignorance, a violent gust did its utmost to unseat her. She clutched desperately at her borrowed garment, pulling the lapels more tightly around her body, and her fingers met with something wet. Aliza drew her hand away sharply, inspecting the moisture under the moonlight before pinning Cyrus with a look of abject fear.
"There's blood on your coat," she breathed.
Cyrus's cool stare gave no indication of his feelings on the matter. He said only, "I'm certain you boast intellect enough to imagine how difficult it is to kill a man without soiling one's clothes."
Aliza looked away and swallowed.
Only now did she realize that Cyrus and Kamran had been left alone for some time in the wake of her unceremonious departure, before which Cyrus had been poised to deliver Kamran a fatal blow. She knew better than to betray her emotions on the matter, but how would she ever be at ease if she did not ask? She had to know. She had to find a way to determine whether he'd finished the task. "How had the Crown Prince come to know your name?" Aliza startled, so unnerved she nearly dropped the coat.
"What?"
she said, turning slowly to face Cyrus. Anger flared to life in his eyes.
"Come now. We've been doing so well. Let's not evolve backward, insulting each other with exhibitions of ignorance. You've proven far more clever than that."
Aliza felt her heart fail.
"Cyrus, how does he know your name?" he demanded. "It was my understanding that you lived in hiding as a labouring servant. What reason might have an empire's heir to intimately acquaint himself with a maid?"
Aliza touched trembling fingers to her lips.
"You did kill him, didn't you?"
"I see we're both eager for explanations as concerns the nascent king of Ardunia."
"You astonish me," she whispered. "First you entrap me in this poisonous scheme, then you demand an admission of my private thoughts, as if you have any right to my honesty.
As your betrothed, I have a right to know of your history."
"We are not betrothed.
You misunderstand me," he said, cutting her off. "If you think I arrived at this degrading juncture in my life on the basis of honour and goodwill, I bound my life to yours before I even knew your name, before I had any idea who you were or what you looked like. Why you seem to derive so much pleasure from thinking my interest in marrying you has some sordid personal motivation, I cannot imagine. Tell me," he said viciously, "is it terribly thrilling to imagine yourself the sole object of my thoughts and desires? Do you purposely deny me ownership of basic dignities, excluding from your memories the essential fact that I was forced into this situation just as you were, all in the pursuit of feeling sorry for yourself?" He shook his head. "My, but it must be exhausting to be a narcissist."
Aliza laughed at that, the sound bordering on hysterical. "You accuse me of narcissism, when your every action has been in the interest of your own protection. The lives of others be damned."
"And you," he said, tilting his head at her, "so preoccupied with your own personal dramas, it never once occurred to you to ask why I might be yoked to such a despicable master."
"Am I meant to feel sorry for you?" she snapped. "You, who no doubt suffer now the consequences of your own sins, lured a sacrificial lamb into this reprehensible arrangement like the most hateful charlatan. You sent me magical garments under the guise of friendship. You led me to believe that you were helping me, that you cared."
"I did no such thing," he said, looking away. "You drew the conclusions that best suited you, and these are the results. Your naivete is no fault of mine."
Aliza was dumbfounded. "How? How can you feel no remorse for what you've done?"
He turned to face her.
"Why do you continue to act as if I had a choice?"
Aliza drew back, but Cyrus was undaunted. He closed the inches between them, his glittering eyes assessing her face now with a renewed fervour. "Do I appear to you a free man boasting of free will?
Or perhaps you thought that after lowering myself to execute the obscene demands of the devil himself, I might take one look at your wide, doe-like eyes and experience a change of heart?
No, she whispered. That is not what I...
Yes, he said softly, his gaze dropping briefly to her mouth. You are well aware of your beauty, I think, much as I am well aware of the manoeuvres of the devil and the weakness of human flesh. You think me so ignorant of his schemes? From the very moment I saw you, I suspected his game. I knew he'd sent you to me, specifically, to torture me, as if I might be so tempted by the sight of you that I would bend in but a moment to your wishes, abandoning in the process an oath I signed with my soul, ensuring I am bound to him forevermore. No, I will not be moved by you, and you have underestimated me if you think I will succumb to your charms.
Sir, I fear you have lost your mind, Aliza said, her heart racing wildly in her chest. You misjudge me terribly.
And you take me for a fool, he said angrily, the movement in his throat briefly distracting her. This story is both odious and familiar, and I already know how it ends. Indeed, I have already seen the consequences of your seductions. Just tonight you snapped in half the spine of one sovereign. I will not be the next.
What on earth can you mean? She breathed, panic intensifying. You sentence me for crimes I wouldn't even know how to commit.
He leaned in, so close she could feel his whisper against her lips as he spoke. Try to weaponize those eyes against me again, and I will have them permanently sewn shut. The Noster flashed hot against her skin, and Aliza gasped, horror briefly paralyzing her in place. Cyrus drew back. If you wish to ingest poison after we exchange our vows, I will not stand in your way. But I will marry you, he said sharply, for you do not know what I stand to lose if this arrangement goes awry. You cannot even begin to imagine. So spare me your tears. You have confused me for your melancholy king, and you will suffer for the delusion.
As if in direct violation of his command, tears threatened her vision, blunting the stars beyond his head, blurring the sharp planes of his face. The magnitude of this impending horror was cementing more in every moment, and Aliza was surprised to discover the depth of her fear. A single tear escaped her then, and she saw Cyrus track its progress down her cheek toward her mouth, and she swiped at the moisture before the salt of it touched her lips. The abrupt action appeared to startle him.
I truly hate you, she whispered, her voice thick with emotion. With my whole heart, I hate you.
Cyrus held her gaze for what seemed a brutally long time before he finally tore away. He said nothing. That Aliza heard the slight tremor in his breath when he finally exhaled, or that she noticed the unsteadiness with which he touched his fingers to the brim of his hat, did not rate mention. She would not feel compassion for a fiend. Then, in the distance, Aliza gasped.
Do prepare yourself, said Cyrus, his tone softer than she expected. It can be a little startling when you see it for the first time.
She sat up straighter, wiping her eyes.
See what? She asked. What am I looking at?
Toulon.
3. The fire had extinguished upon Cyrus's exit, leaving in its wake a charred impression of a circle, several feet in diameter, the stain of which no amount of soap or toil would eliminate. Of a certainty, the floor itself would have to be demolished and replaced, but then this work could not take precedence.
Prior to fixing the floor, there were other more pressing issues in the palace to contend with. There was, for example, a dead king sprawled at Kamran's feet, a vermeil stain still spreading under his limp figure, while, at his shoulders, the flaccid faces of twin snakes rested delicately upon their own unfurled tongues. The hulking crown of this once illustrious sovereign now glinted upside down in a plash of red. The glossy floor sticky with slipshod streaks of blood, evidence of regicide everywhere. Prominent gashes and abrasions could be catalogued around the perimeter of the imposing ballroom, where the dragon's studded tail had whipped through not merely the stonework, but glittering sconces, heavy drapery, and priceless artwork, all of which would need to be discarded, their substitutes promptly sourced. Still, the physical destruction most distressing was perhaps also the most obvious. There was a massive crater in the palace wall. It was a cavity so large it brought to mind the perpetually shrieking mouth of a newborn babe. It gaped unabashedly open, an eclipse of moths fluttering in and out of its crumbling aperture, not unlike a horde of dithering idiots. The detritus of the evening's chaos would be a task of its own to manage. Debris littered all and sundry, heavy dust powdering the hair and shoulders of scandalized nobles, all of whom stood around now, shock briefly muzzling their aristocratic mouths, hands clasped to cheeks and hearts as their heads swiveled between horrors. The dead king, the destroyed wall, the ossified air? Yes, there was a great deal of work to be done. The wreckage alone would take days to sweep up, and Kamran would have to charge Jamshid, the palace butler, with the task of contracting stonemasons to repair all else with celerity. There was too much at stake. Already there would be a week of mourning before Kamran could be crowned king in an elaborate ceremony, after which he would finally carry out his grandfather's most impassioned command and choose a damn bride, any bride. And only then, only when that grim business was sorted, could he move on to the most important task, which was to officially declare war against Tulan. He would avenge both his father and his grandfather. He would have Cyrus's head. He would bring Tulan to its knees, and Aliza. No, he would not think of her now. Not when the very thought of her tore open fresh wounds inside him. He could not reconcile so many horrors at once. First, he would have to cease being stone. There were swarms of people drawing near him now, all of them staring, speaking about him like he might be dead, which struck Kamran as a terrible taunt, for death seemed a far more pleasurable fate than this. Is it the light, dear? Or does he look disfigured to you? By the angels, what a terrifying sight! First the king, now the prince. Who is the girl? Does anyone know? Too soon to tell. The fate of our empire. Will someone touch him to see if he moves? An ugly business, terribly ill-bred. You cannot simply touch the Prince of Ardunia. Anyone understand what she was saying? I only, but thought she was helping until she ran off with the dragon. Could be dead, really. Why can't we do something about the king? This is so distasteful. We could throw a sheet over him. Or move him, you idiot. Dark magic. Oh, dark magic, to be sure. He says something about a djinn queen to rule the world. I, too, struggled to hear the girl. Are you suggesting I touch those snakes? Are you really suggesting I touch those snakes? Where are the servants? Complete nonsense.
djinn royalty died out ages ago. But you were able to see her then. Sometimes she really seemed to blur. The servants? They appear to have run away. Look, he's still bleeding.
Ha! It's more likely you've had too much wine. Am I meant to call for my own carriage, then?
Appalling, really. Simply appalling. What on earth do you think is happening to his face?
True, there existed no criterion for managing the present situation. Kamran had sympathy enough to understand that. But this stream of insipid, unproductive commentary was punctuated by random shrieks and shouts, all of which so aggressively thrashed his frayed nerves that he wished with great passion that the mass of imbeciles might drop dead. It required every bit of his energy to keep his mind sharp, as pain battered his body, electric spasms seizing his chest, his neck, even aspects of his face, so much so that Kamran didn't know how much more he might withstand. He was well aware his body was bleeding out, his lungs compressing under the ever-increasing weight of this magic. Still, he dared hope he might not die. It was Cyrus's parting words that kept him calm, kept his mind from unravelling, for it seemed clear that if the Southern Royal had meant to kill him, surely he would have. But Cyrus had wanted him to live. The demented king had claimed a desire to see Kamran survive, if only to watch him suffer. Indeed, Cyrus seemed to look forward to his survival and to the inevitability of their next skirmish. How, then, might Kamran be released from this prison? Without a doubt, there were living diviners capable of undoing such magic, but they were scattered across Ardunia. It would take weeks to collect enough of them to form the necessary quorum at the diviners' quarters, but with an urgent summons, it was possible to deliver to the palace whichever diviner was nearest. Even one might do just fine. Perhaps if Hazan hadn't proven an unfaithful bastard, he might have already issued such a summons. Doubtless, Hazan would have handled every detail of this horrific night with aplomb, stepping gingerly over pools of blood, only to usher home the affronted nobles with a smile. Even Kamran, who intended to kill his former minister, could acknowledge this truth, and experienced at the thought a resulting pang in his chest. Nevertheless, Kamran would not allow himself to dwell on Hazan's betrayal. There was no point, and there was no time. If only he could speak, Kamran would direct the masses himself. He would right now be shouting commands into this sea of gaping half-wits, some too busy proving their delicate constitutions by repeatedly fainting into the arms of their escorts. Others too accustomed to the softness of peacetime to remember how to react in a crisis. Kamran would not refute it. He loathed his peers. He hated their pretensions, their obsessions with frivolity, their quiet competitions to crush each other with displays of imagined superiority. He resented that he belonged to their circles at all, resented that his new role would force him to spend more time in their company, resented his birthright altogether. It was then, in an extraordinary moment, that the impending king of Ardunia realized he wanted his mother. She had been here. He knew she'd been here, for much earlier in the evening he'd seen her sitting in a throne adjacent to his grandfather. Surely she'd not abandoned the party before witnessing the night's devastations. Surely she still owned a fraction of a heart, a lingering ounce of maternal affection for her only child. Why, then, had she not come to his aid? Had she not been bothered to watch him suffer? Would that he might search the room for her, but Kamran could not shift even his eyes.
His mother's ominous last warnings began to pound in his head, reminding him that he'd treated her poorly, startling him to realize how she'd predicted his future just hours ago. "Soon," she'd said, "I will be all you have left in this palace. You will walk the halls, friendless and alone, and you will search for me then. You will want your mother only when all else is lost. And I do not promise to be easily found." She'd been wrong on one important count. Kamran could not at the moment walk the halls of this castle. But if he survived the night, there might be time yet for that too. How easily Kamran had dismissed her warning. Now his mother was absent, his grandfather was dead, his minister was shackled in the dungeons. Even his aunt, with whom he'd been speaking just seconds before identifying Cyrus in the crush, was conspicuously truant. The truth of his situation bore down on him with a chilling awareness. He had no one. There was a sudden moment of shoving before a familiar greasy figure was revealed in his attempt to part the throng, his forceful actions rippling through the swarm of spectators, the lot of which went abruptly silent upon sighting him. The defence minister, whose name was Zahak, was a slight balding man of average height, whose face was more often than not a reflective surface, for it retained always a slick sheen. Tonight his skin seemed to glister more than usual as he pushed forward, the blue-green whirl of his robes representing the colours of the noble house of Ketab. He forged a path through the assemblage with an air of authority so desperately required of the situation that every head turned to track his movements, all awaiting with bated breath a pronouncement that might allow them to finally exit this tragic stage and retire to their beds. Dread coiled in Kamran's gut. Zahak was a character he heartily detested. Just yesterday, Kamran had unapologetically insulted the aristocrat in a room full of his peers. Hateful as the defence minister was, Kamran's actions had been foolish, and it was only as the oily figure examined Kamran's unflinching face now, his beady black eyes gleaming with something like triumph, that Kamran realized the depth of his error. Zahak was a truculent man, and yet too craven to lift a sword in his own defence. Instead, he carried into every conversation the poison of passive aggression, the preferred weapon of cowards. No doubt he would land a ruinous blow now.
"I'm afraid," Zahak said calmly, his voice ringing out in the silence, "that we've no choice but to declare the prince dead."
The crowd gasped, then drew back in unison. So shocking was this pronouncement that Kamran felt it as a physical electrification inside his heart, and then just as swiftly this feeling was displaced by shame, for the magnitude of his astonishment struck him only as a reflection of his own stupidity. His grandfather had tried to warn him of such machinations, and Kamran had given the words no weight. As if conjured from the ether, he heard Zal's whisper,
"My child, do you not understand how precarious your position is? Those who covet your position would invite any reason to deem you unworthy of the throne."
Kamran had never thought himself naive, and yet he'd not endured much more than an hour in the absence of his grandfather's protection, and already he'd been filleted open, the infantile contents of his mind exposed, the truth of his sheltered life laid bare. Kamran was the very definition of a fool. He'd anticipated none of the betrayals he'd suffered tonight, so comfortable had he been in his role,
so certain had he been of his authority in the world. Now he was a caged animal for the world to gawk at, stripped of all that ever defined him in but a matter of moments. Never had he felt so powerless. The murmurs of the crowd had grown only more frantic in the interlude, and Kamran raged within the prison of his body, his blood heating, even as his lungs continued to compress. Zahak, meanwhile, preened as he faced the people, imitation grief colouring his voice as it carried across the room.
"My dear nobles, this has been a grave night indeed. To have lost both our emperor and our heir in the same hour and under such ghastly circumstances,"
someone sobbed loudly.
"But I stand before you tonight to offer this assurance. Ardunia is too great an empire to be felled even by these great tragedies. Even so," he went on, "the unpalatable particulars that led to the murder of our beloved king will require immense scrutiny. A council of house leaders will be assembled on the morrow, during which time we will decide whether retribution is befitting of the situation, and begin a search to select a worthy inheritor of the throne. Until then, as dictated by Ardunian law, I shall assume temporary ownership of the crown and forthwith sue for peace with Tulan, so that we might, without delay, return our empire to the state of tranquility we've come to enjoy."
A ferocious pain detonated without warning in Kamran's shoulder, the unmistakable weight of a blade piercing his flesh in a moment that struck him only as surreal. The puncture awoke inside him an unnatural cold, a unique torment that flashed through his veins with such severity he cried out in anguish. He was unaware the sound had escaped his lips, until he heard the shattering clang of his sword, steel striking the floor as it fell from his unfrozen hand, his knees knocking stone when his legs gave out, his thawed body trembling with abandon. By agonizing degrees, Kamran lifted his head. The din of the room had silenced in an instant, astonishment rendering all mouths immobile for the length of a miraculous moment. Kamran, in his bewilderment, did not hear the bumbling stupefaction of the defence minister, now desperately backpedalling, nor did he bother to pass the whispers of the crowd, now regenerating around him. No, Kamran was too preoccupied by the piece of evidence buried in his muscle. He had been attacked. He reached up with one shaking arm to pull free the ruby dagger planted in his left shoulder, the action so excruciating he nearly lost consciousness in the effort. He felt himself begin to convulse even as he examined the decadent weapon, the room appearing to swim before him. This blade. He knew this blade. Kamran turned his head with difficulty, his skull swinging with the grace of a pendulum as he searched the room for his assailant. At least the miracle of his release had a clear enough explanation. The glittering scarlet dagger had cut through his enchantment, which meant the weapon had once been fortified by the diviners, the better to empower its owner against an enemy whose armour might be coated in magical protections. In and of itself, this was not a notable discovery, for such fortifications were common in the reinforcement of royal weapons. Kamran's own swords boasted the same benefits. Far more interesting was the near assassination itself, for in his mind there existed but one person alive who would risk killing Kamran in the pursuit of his survival. The dagger had belonged to his mother. Unsuccessfully he scanned the room for her face, increasingly perplexed by her actions.
His mother had saved him. Why then had she abandoned?
Kamran went deathly still. It was not magic this time, but fear that paralyzed him anew, for he'd glimpsed his reflection in a bank of shattered mirrors gracing an adjacent wall. Dumbstruck, he lifted an unsteady hand to his chin, his cheek, the delicate lid of one eye. Earlier, the decorative mirrors had adorned the ballroom at intervals to great effect, enhancing the flicker of crystal and fire, and the fractured light of 100 glimmering chandeliers, elevating in the process the ambience of a dignified evening to dizzying heights. Now, the broken glass cast back only monstrous scenes, chief among them a likeness of himself he was not yet ready to fathom into words. He lacked the privilege of time even to process the transformation, for it was but an instant later that Zahak fell theatrically to his knees. At once, the sheep encircling him followed suit.
"Your Highness!" Zahak cried. "We'd not dared to hope for such a miracle. There can be no doubt but that our empire has been blessed by the heavens."
Kamran studied the sea of nobles kneeling before him with a vague disgust. Even now their duplicity was on display. These sycophants bowed without a word, motionless as glass, even as their uncrowned king failed to stand upright, his broken body bleeding. They did not rush to his side, call for a surgeon, order a litter to carry him to safety. No, they did not seem to care that he was dying. And Kamran was indeed dying. The restoration of his movements had returned him to himself, yes, but the rewiring of faculty and flesh had awakened in the process every brutal devastation his body had sustained this night. Kamran could feel that something was irrevocably wrong with him. It was more than the grisly transformation of his face. His lungs rattled when he inhaled. Galvanic pain pulsed in his eyes. His vision faded in and out as bright white light overexposed his sight with increasing frequency. His charred arms and legs still bled profusely, and worse, would no longer obey a command to desist shaking. There was something the matter with his chest, too. His heart felt both fast and sluggish, an ache like bones breaking where a soft organ was meant to beat. He'd lost too much blood, perhaps, or sustained a blow to his lungs, or maybe he'd been frozen for too long, his many injuries growing only more gruesome in the interim. Whatever the reason, his death seemed now an inevitability. Without the immediate application of a powerful restorative magic, Kamran knew he would soon lose the ability even to speak, for it was growing only more difficult to breathe. That he maintained his composure at all was a result only of violent determination, and it was a miracle that he managed to speak clearly when he said, breathing hard,
"Fetch me the nearest diviner, with all possible haste." "Yes, sire, right away, sire."
Compelled into motion, Zahak barked at a footman to ready a team of horses, snapping orders at gaping servants who'd materialized from the shadows only in the wake of Kamran's reanimation. If he survived this infernal night, the gossip alone would be hell to endure.
"The rest of you,"
Kamran said, staring blearily into the genuflecting crowd.
"Go home."
When the petrified mass made no move, Kamran grew lightheaded with anger.
"Now!"
he bellowed, his lungs seizing in the effort. The horde unfolded with a series of shrieks before bolting for the exits, silken tulles shuddering as the ballroom was evacuated in a single exhalation. Finally, he was alone. Or at least,
appeared to be. Kamran suspected there lingered wide-eyed servants in the wings, still watching him, but he could neither move nor risk raising his voice again, for his last attempt had so diminished his intake of air that every breath felt like pulling gasps through a pinhole. There was nothing for it. Kamran finally sagged to the floor, grimacing through the relentless pain still ravaging his body. The room tilted as he collapsed, supine in a sea of devastation. His only companion, the body of a dead king, the cold blood of his beloved grandfather, pooling ever closer to his own shaking limbs. Were Kamran a different sort of man, he might have acquiesced then to a terrifying compulsion. He felt in that moment nothing greater than an ancient impulse to cry, valiantly resisting the instinct, even as a flare of grief tore through him. He had never felt more desperately alone in the world than he did then, trapped in the set piece of a nightmare, in the failing flesh of his own body. His mother had done him a mercy, but she'd promptly vanished. There was no one left he might trust, no one upon whom he might rely. The thought threatened to break him, and he vehemently refused it residence in his mind. He would not die. Dying would mean he'd failed his king twice, and this Kamran could not allow. He fought to stay conscious, even as violent spasms racked his bones. He had to live long enough to murder those who'd wronged him, to avenge his father, his grandfather. He would survive this barrage of murders upon his soul. If he had to, he would lift this broken empire upon his own shaking shoulders. Sire? Kamran's heart seized. His every instinct screamed at him to pull himself upright, but his limbs would not obey. He could only lie there, his chest cratering, until without warning his line of sight was crowded by a mop of red curls hanging over a cowed, freckled face. Omid Shekarzadeh, the street urchin whose attempted thievery had set in motion every recent horrific turn of Kamran's life, stared straight into his eyes.
"You!"
Kamran managed to gasp. He noticed the tears staining the child's cheeks, eyes bloodshot and swollen. The boy, Omid, studied him warily, fear and fascination warring in his expression. Neither said another word, as Omid bent carefully beside the dying king and with a trembling hand withdrew from his pocket a glittering blue sugar cube. Kamran stiffened at the sight.
"I think they knew, sir," Omid said in Feshtun. "The diviners. I think they knew what was going to happen. I think they knew they were going to be murdered."
Kamran felt his heart pounding in his ears. The object Omid held in his hand was a magical ration called Sif. The legendary blue crystals were compressed into bite-sized cubes that had historically been provided to Ardunian royals on the battlefield. So valuable were the lives of emperors and their heirs that the diviners had always sent them to war with these single-use reinforcements. The final blade of fatality, once delivered, none could overcome, but there was a great deal to be done for those even inches from death. Just one Sif was enough to undo even the worst injuries.
"Benges," the child whispered, "take it."
"No, I cannot."
"They gave it to me after I began to recover," the boy said quietly. "Told me to keep it with me always, that I'd know when to use it." He swallowed. "I thought they gave it to me to save myself in the future, see? I didn't realise until just now that maybe I wasn't supposed to use it on myself."
"No,"
Kamran said again, this time sharply. He was seeing stars, bright lights sparking and fading behind his eyes.
if the diviners blessed you with such a gift, he wheezed. You should not. You cannot give it away.
I'll do as I please, said Omid, anger edging into his voice. You saved my life, sire. Now it's my turn to save yours.
4. In the distance, Aliza saw stars, tens of thousands, or perhaps hundreds of thousands, or thousands of thousands. It was impossible to tell, and she seemed incapable of conjuring an estimate large enough to account for them all. She knew only what she saw, and what she saw was a seemingly infinite expanse of densely assembled celestial bodies, all of which appeared to tremble upon approach. They had been sitting in a bleak silence for hours now, and with each flap of the dragon's enormous leathery wings, their small party drew steadily closer to the spectral sight, the distant lights rearranging themselves repeatedly, shifting in erratic patterns. Finally, Aliza frowned. It was very unlike a star to act in such a manner. She turned to her companion for an explanation, but was brought up short by the sight of him. Cyrus sat beside her with a palpable discomfort made apparent in the unnatural stiffness of his body, head up, shoulders back, spine straight. His eyes were fixed firmly ahead, his hair rippling in the wind, longer strands occasionally obscuring his vision. And still, he did not move. It was impossible to know what tormented him the most, and Aliza could not bring herself to care. Her eyes still itched with the remnants of tears. She despised this blackguard, and yet, until she could figure out a plan of action, she would need a great deal from him. His answers about the devil's plans for her, his guidance in navigating Tulan, the offer of a safe place to stay while she gathered her wits and decided her next move. It was a hateful situation, one she would have to manage with all possible caution, and Aliza was still considering this, still examining his stoic features, when his jaw suddenly tightened. Enough, he said sharply. I don't welcome your analysis. Cease studying me. Something bitter prompted her to say, You are not my master. Cyrus turned at once to look at her, staring into her eyes with an intensity that bordered on alarming. Do you aspire to be mine? This question was so shocking, Aliza drew back in response. Cyrus leaned in. Relinquish the dream, he said softly. You have no hope of mastering me. Aliza tensed. I could kill you right now. He only looked at her, a slow smile spreading across his face. Go on then, he said. Kill me. I will not intervene. Her eyes narrowed. I do not dispose of that which is still useful to me. Useful? Is that what you've decided I am? He almost laughed. And do you lie to yourself often? Aliza felt a flash of heat at that, an anger that compelled her into silence, as the two locked eyes then in a vicious contest. Aliza did her utmost to remain still under Cyrus's now ruthless inspection, but the full weight of his scrutiny, at such close proximity, was indeed too much to bear. He seemed to devour her with a single look, his blue gaze holding hers without mercy, before cataloguing every inch of her face, the angle of her jaw, the column of her neck. His eyes were charged with something both electric and devastating, the unbound energy of his entire body diverted to this single avenue of connection. Aliza felt the heat of his slow appraisal in her bones, in the tips of her fingers. Her heart sped up in response, understanding, even as he frightened her, that he was trying to frighten her.
Too soon, Aliza averted her gaze.
As I thought, he whispered. You're too soft even to bear the weight of my attentions.
Aliza laughed quietly as she pressed a finger to the wind, felt the current curl under her touch. The sky too is soft, she said. Yet all who fall into its arms will perish. She felt him stiffen beside her.
You, he said finally, are not who I expected.
Aliza did not reward this with a response, choosing instead to resume her study of the night. They were beginning to descend into Tulan. She could feel it. And as they drew closer to what seemed an endless celebration of jittery lights, her eyes grew wide with wonder.
Tell me, she said, why do these stars move? Is there magic in the heavens here?
Those are very different questions, said Cyrus, whose eyes she felt fixed on her face. As for the first, they move because they are not stars.
She glanced at him, eyebrows high.
You will soon learn that Tulan is crowned by a series of protective skies, he explained. The fireflies live in our third atmosphere, where they gather in such large numbers they present almost as small galaxies, or even terrifying ghosts, from afar. It can be a little disconcerting to the unaccustomed eye.
Fireflies, Aliza said, turning fully to face him. How?
There was an unexpected swell of sound then, a mellifluous harmony that crescendoed as she went suddenly weightless, suspended in mid-air for the length of a single breath, before they plummeted at breakneck velocity through a bloat of clouds. Aliza grasped desperately at nothing, nearly losing her seat as strong gales pushed open the flaps of her borrowed coat and promptly tore the oversized garment from her body, tossing the article in the sky. Aliza heard Cyrus's cry of frustration, even as she nearly screamed in pain. The cold bit into her uncovered flesh with an unexpected brutality, and in a moment propelled by nothing more than desperation, did she finally find purchase at the nape of the dragon's neck, holding fast as they bore down with increasing speed. Wind barreled relentlessly against her exposed body, battering her over and over as her hair spiraled in a storm of its own, loose tendrils occasionally snapping with static. It was only after they were wrung from the clouds and released back into the open air that Aliza felt the shimmer of dew on her skin, the damp press of her tattered dress against her body. The landscape below her came into a vague focus, the hush and roar of that distant resonance growing only more deafening. Howling squalls still thrashed her face, an unnamed crash and clamour rising to a decibel level nearly incalculable, until finally Aliza understood. What she heard was water. They had to be above the ocean. This much had to be true. But then the smell of wet soil filled her head, confusing her, and she was at once consumed by the bracing scent of rain and the heavy cloak of mist, the latter promptly obscuring her vision. Aliza struggled to stare through the fog at the scene below, condensation settling in her hair, vapour clinging to her eyelashes. She climbed closer to the head of the dragon, deaf to the sound of Cyrus calling her back, and locked her arms as best she could around the beast's neck before pressing her face deeper into the fog. In the shattering moonlight, she saw the faint outline of what appeared to be the end of the earth. A colossal sequence of staircase waterfalls had been born at the top of towering cliffs, the cataracts emptying into the ocean from varying and terrifying heights. The scene was, in fact, so sublime that Aliza experienced an inexpressible joyful fear in its presence.
She'd never seen such steep bluffs, nor such devastating cascades, and she was still trying to digest the magnificence of it all when she remembered suddenly to look up. Her face was met with an exhalation of mist, ocean spray glazing her body as her lips parted in awe, then exhilaration. She distinguished the stark lines of turrets in the night sky, the formidable outline of what could only be a royal palace balanced upon the cliff's edge, its foundations planted at the base of hundreds of falls, so majestic her breath caught at the sight. Water! She could hardly believe it. Djinn's bodies were forged from fire, yes, but water was their true mainstay in life. Unlike other living creatures, Djinn did not require food for survival. It was this precious elixir alone that had allowed Aliza's ancestors to survive eons of a frozen, sunless existence on Earth. And it was no surprise, then, that Aliza felt most alive only when she drew nearer to water, when she drank it, bathed in it, when she lifted her face to the rain. Aliza closed her eyes, felt the spindrift wash over her. They were approaching the castle with great determination now. The closer they drew, the more intensely she experienced the unrelenting drizzle, and she made no effort to take cover. Instead, Aliza leaned in only farther, licking the water from her lips, inhaling the scent of sodden earth, damp moss, wet pine. She was soon drenched and frozen half to death, shivering uncontrollably and still undeterred. Her long curls were heavy and dripping, rivulets snaking down her face, her neck, running along her collarbone. Aliza paid these discomforts no attention. She couldn't remember the last time she'd experienced such heady relief. Her daily baths at the local hammam were nothing compared to this, to the magnificence of an overwhelming ocean, to the fervour and mercy of the sea. It was as if she'd been returned home. This dream was crudely interrupted by an ungentlemanly word, released by a familiar voice. Cyrus's arms came suddenly around her waist, too easily plucking her off the dragon's neck and planting her back onto their shared seat, the patterned rug beneath them now damp with ocean spray. He drew away from her at once. "Good Lord," he said, shaking out his hands. "You're soaking wet. Why are you acting as if you've never seen water before?" Aliza hardly heard him. She was too overcome with exhilaration, and as a result, did not think before she smiled at Cyrus, turning the full force of her joy in his direction, eyes squinting, cheeks dimpling, chest heaving with excitement. Cyrus went inhumanly still, then turned sharply away. "You act as if you've never met a djinn before," Aliza said breathlessly. "I love the water. I live for it." "On the contrary," he said flatly, still avoiding the sight of her. "I've met thousands of djinn, and I've never seen a single one of them nearly fling themselves into the ocean." Aliza was offered no opportunity to respond. The dragon made its final descent without warning and without grace, wings clipping the falls as they approached land, dousing them both with fresh water in the process. Aliza heard Cyrus swear as the animal hit the ground hard, forelegs first, then back legs, stomping to a halt in a series of drunken thumps, the reverberations of which made Aliza's teeth chatter. "She's very tired," Cyrus muttered by way of apology. Aliza said nothing. It was a moment before she was even able to shake herself free of whiplash, carefully collecting her mind in the midst of this current astonishment. They'd come to an abrupt stop on a stretch of flat, mossy land upon one of the higher cliffs,
Where the roar of the water grew so loud, the two of them would have no choice but to cease speaking, or else scream at each other, granting Aliza the quiet she needed to survey her new surroundings. It was a shame, then, that they had arrived in the dark, for she could make out only faded impressions of the royal grounds. Even so, she was thunderstruck. The jagged, staggering castle appeared to be fashioned from glittering stone, for the smooth exterior glinted under the undiluted glow of starlight, casting constellations upon her skin, the scattered trees, even the leathery beast still kneeling beneath her. No doubt it was the late hour, her extreme fatigue, and the emotional obliteration of the evening that were to blame for her disorientation, but Aliza was so affected by the surrealism of the moment that she felt a bit out of her mind. Her own bones seemed foreign to her. Even when she shivered, she felt as if she were experiencing it from afar. Frost had begun to crystallize along her eyelashes, upon the stiffening tendrils of her hair. She was so numb with cold she could hardly feel her extremities anymore, but neither could she bring herself to hurry indoors into the arms of an unknown fate. Cyrus, meanwhile, stared a beat too long at what was ostensibly his own home, and released a heavy sigh. He disembarked in a brisk, fluid motion, landing firmly on his feet and not bothering to look back, leaving Aliza to topple off the dragon in an inelegant heap. She drew herself up and looked around, trying and failing to take in the magnitude of this new setting. The air felt fresher here, crisp and delicious in a way that reminded her of childhood, and she couldn't get enough of it. She inhaled over and over in quick succession, and soon grew lightheaded. Feeling delirious, she peered up and gasped. Where the royal palace in Ardunia was an arresting work of art, sprawled leisurely upon hundreds of acres, this Tulanian stronghold was forced to fashion its palatial size upon a modest plain offered by a steep cliff. Aliza supposed it was for this reason that the castle was so dizzyingly vertiginous. Then again, it might have been done simply to intimidate. Gilded spires pierced the heavens above her, impaling stars, grazing the moon, and disappeared fully into the clouds, a herd of which crowned the palace like a halo. Aliza was unable even to see the top, so tall was the edifice, and she lifted a frozen hand to her mouth, astonishment forcing her eyes wide. The sky, meanwhile, was beginning to show telltale signs of dawn. The heaviness of night drew back in an unhurried reveal, inches of dark pleating away, not unlike curtains on a stage. An audience of one stood impatient before the sight, waiting with bated breath for the set dressing of the next scene, the next act in her life. Aliza felt a terrible sense of foreboding. Nevertheless, a golden radiance soon illuminated the world, fingers of light touching trees and birds as if counting its children. Aliza thought to search for Cyrus then, and found him tending to the dragon, first dropping a massive bucket of water at the creature's feet, then procuring from nowhere a single apple, which he polished against his shirt before holding under the animal's nose. The beast opened its mouth with a pitiful whine, curls of smoke puffing from its nostrils, before it snatched, in a terrifying bite, the offering from Cyrus's open hand. Aliza thought she might have seen the demented king smile. The king in question stroked the dragon's head with the tenderness of a child before leaving the beast to its water. He walked briskly toward a steel chest,
which appeared to have been delivered in anticipation of their arrival, and threw back the heavy lid, withdrawing from the trunk's belly an enormous platter heaving with dead animals. Eliza turned away. She need not watch the dragon eat a grisly meal. She felt she'd been served more than her fill of bloody images this night. In any case, Cyrus's current preoccupation was a mercy she would not squander. Aliza's mind was spinning with a multitude of pressing complications, and she was grateful for the solitude, for the moment to think. She still hadn't decided what to do. Outrunning the devil was hopeless, she knew that, but participating in this twisted game felt equally impossible. She would not marry Cyrus, at least. This first step seemed clear enough. It was what came next that confounded her. Aliza had been exposed, actively hunted by two empires, and while she'd managed to outrun one, she'd been easily caught in the maw of another, forced now to play a role in the devil's schemes. This web was now too intricate, her existence too well documented. She didn't think she could return to a life of obscurity until she'd felled her enemies, and hers were formidable indeed. Aliza clenched her shaking hands. Oh, she had never feared death. No, it was life that scared her, life that scarred her. It was the slow torture of consciousness that had done its utmost to crush her. Aliza was meant to be the salvation of her people, destined to save the djinn of this world from the horrors they'd endured for centuries. How could she not carry the weight of this failure with her always? The burden had been hers to bear, and she'd borne it badly. Now she was trapped between a deranged king and the devil himself, and she feared for a terrible moment that she might fail to overcome this too. A wave of panic seized her body. Aliza's legs shook, her knees suddenly giving out. She staggered back a step, the heels of her bare feet striking the trunk of the nearest tree. She braced herself against its heft, her head filling with the scent of pine. She'd grown used to the sound of the rushing water now, experiencing it more as a comforting hum than a distracting noise, and as her heart steadied, she was better able to discern the sounds of leaves fluttering, a charm of birds chirping melodies into the sunrise. Aliza drew a deep, steadying breath. She reminded herself to take comfort, as she always had, in the strength she carried in her body, in her mind, in the faith she'd always had in herself. She was not stupid enough to think she could find her way to safety in her current state, bedraggled, destitute, and ignorant of this foreign landscape. Nor was she delusional enough to trust anyone she might encounter in Toulon. Instead, she thought she might take a day or two to assess her new circumstances, bide her time until she could form a plan. Besting Cyrus, at least, would be the easier task, for she knew he was but a pawn in this scheme. It was Iblis she'd need to outmaneuver. Aliza was still contemplating this when she heard the soft, unexpected voice of a stranger calling her name. She stiffened at once, fear bolting through her afresh. Carefully, she turned to face the new arrival.